want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear a very important interview with journalist Robert Perry. He builds on the recent revelations supplied by muckraker Seymour Hersh about what really happened in the Damascus suburb last August 21st. And what we can confirm is that the assertions of President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry that Syria used chemical weapons, well, there is no evidence to support that, and a lot of information that points in other directions. It's an important interview, and in the show file, there are links to Robert Perry's recent report and the important journalism from Seymour Hersh, published in the London Review of Books. And before we get to it, I want to thank the people who subscribe and support this program, like Jeff Zeiser, Michelle Pasco in Sacramento, James Hallwell in Northern California, and Michael Sevilla. They all pump in $5 or $10 a month to support my work, and I'd like you to do the same. Just go to my website. Under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com, click on the link that says sign up. You'll face choices, $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription and new annual subscribers in the U.S. of A. Get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans grown on the Big Island of Hawaii. I want to thank all the people who support my work and encourage you to do so if you haven't been among them in the past. Last August, President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry flatly accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons. The case was weak then. It's even weaker now. The deception with tight. Just what are you trying to say? You got a blank face, which irritates. Communicate, pull out your body piece. You see dimensions in two. State your case with black or white. But when one little cross leads to shots, grit your teeth. You run for cover so discreet. Do what you say, say what you mean. One thing leads to another. Robert Perry returns to our program today. He, of course, is the journalist who publishes at consortiumnews.com. And on the heels of an important article by Seymour Hersh, published a few days ago at the London Review of Books, we are taking a look back all the way back to last August. That's August of 2013. Bob Perry, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Peter B.
When the news broke that there had been a chemical weapons incident in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta last August, the U.S. pounced and immediately declared that they had solid knowledge. They never provided any evidence. They simply asserted that they had knowledge that this was done by the Syrian military. And it's always been doubtful because there were U.N. weapons inspectors who had just arrived in Damascus a day or two before. And many of the facts were either contradictory or didn't comport with the assertions of the U.S. Let's start by talking about those events of August, and then we'll advance to what we know now, or at least have firmer speculation about. But you have noted that the assertions by our government were not based on intelligence. They were based on murky so-called assessments, Bob.
Well, the U.S. government claimed to have evidence. They've suggested that it related to intercepts, satellite video of rockets being launched, and they said this confirmed to them that this was done by the Syrian government. They also asserted that because at least the initial thought was this was a fairly widespread attack involving multiple rockets, possibly seven or more rockets carrying chemical weapons, that only the Syrian government could have carried it out. And so that was sort of what they claimed. They did not provide a shred of evidence. They did not provide any of these intercepts. They did not provide any of this supposed video they had of these rockets being launched. They provided nothing. And what happened subsequent to that was that when the U.N., which was already the U.N. inspectors were there, they'd been invited in by the Syrian government to examine another chemical weapons incident, which the Syrian government was blaming on the rebels. And as these U.N. inspectors were unpacking, and also as the rebels were really losing ground, they were beginning the war had really turned in favor of the government at that point, This incident happened. So there was always this question, as you pointed out, why would Assad have done this, which was not only going to divert the U.N. inspectors, but cross Obama's red line, which would have brought the United States in militarily on the side of the rebels.
Mm-hmm.
But as it's turned out, once the U.N. inspectors then were diverted to go to the Ghouta suburbs, they found two suspicious rockets. One was in Mu'ammadima, which is south of Damascus, and one was in Zamalka, which is to the east of Damascus. Now, when they did their checks on these rockets, the one that landed in Mu'ammadima was found to have contained no sarin and no chemical weapons agents of any kind. So it was not a delivery system for bringing sarin to that part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
They did find sarin in the other one that landed in Zamalka. This was a very crude rocket that had been sort of redesigned to carry a load of sarin, and But so already the main contention of the U.S. government that there had been multiple rocket fires, that this had, and therefore only the government could do it, had been disproved. Now, when it came to this one rocket that carried the sarin, which killed several hundred people apparently, what was later determined by rocket experts, including the U.N., but also private experts in U.S. academia, was that this rocket, as it was designed, would have a maximum range of 2 to 3 kilometers, and the assumption had been, the claim had been, that these rockets had been fired from a Syrian military base 9.5 kilometers away. So it became an impossibility. And in fact, if you looked at the U.S. maps of who controlled what neighborhoods at that time, if you did a circle over the 2 to 3 kilometers, you'd be into rebel territory. So in other words, it wasn't even government-controlled territory where this rocket would have originated. In other words, the whole thing was collapsing. It was falling apart. The main claims have not been substantiated. In fact, they've been, in many cases, refuted. In the face of this mounting collapse of this evidence, the Obama administration has continued to assert that it has the solid evidence, that there's no question about this, but they will still not provide a shred of what they have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are. That's where we were until Cy Hirsch's piece this past weekend.
And just to underscore the significance of this, and I know many of my listeners recall this vividly, but some people after 6 or 8 months forget. But Obama took us to the brink of war. And only when he took this unusual step of saying, well, I'm going to consult with Congress, and Congress clearly was opposed to it, and there was a fairly widespread reaction by average Americans, no, we don't want to get involved militarily in Syria. And so these are not minor issues. And what Seymour Hersh has reported in this new dispatch is that British scientists took a look at the sample of the sarin that was used in this attack last August 21st and demonstrated that the gas used doesn't match the batches known to exist in the Syrian Army's chemical weapons arsenal. So that mismatch is very significant. It is exculpatory to the Assad government and its military arms. Then we have to, you know, pursue other theories about who actually might have been responsible. But this exoneration of the Syrian government, I think, is a very significant development in this story, Bob. And in my reading, I haven't seen anybody other than you and some bloggers pick up on Hersh's revelations. And frankly, I haven't seen it in the New York Times. Have you?
No, I mean, obviously there's been debate that goes back to that time frame about who could have produced the sarin, and theoretically, even if it's not known to have been in the Syrian government arsenal, that doesn't mean that the Syrian government could not have produced it any more than it doesn't mean that the rebels could not have produced it.
Good point.
But you know, basically, I think we still have to say we don't really know who carried this out. What we can say, I think, with very strong confidence at this point, is that the claims that were being made by the Obama administration, and particularly by Secretary of State John Kerry, were false. That they knew for certainty that there was no doubt that this was something that the U.S. intelligence community was on board with. I was being told at the time that there was substantial dissent within the U.S. intelligence community about who had been responsible.
Mm-hmm.
There was some people thought it was the Syrian government. Some thought it was the rebels. Some weren't sure. But what was then done, the sleight of hand that was pulled by the Obama administration, was that instead of doing a national intelligence estimate, which is the usual step when you're going to do something as serious as go to war, the national intelligence estimate would be the consensus view of the 16 intelligence agencies. And most importantly, the NIE would include footnotes listing where people dissented. So if, say, a few of the intelligence agencies disagreed, that would be there. So instead of doing an NIE and putting that out with the dissents, what the Obama administration did was it invented a new vehicle called a government assessment. And the government assessment was basically a 3 or 4 page white paper, which made a lot of assessments and assertions, but contained no verifiable evidence at all. And it did not include any of the dissents, because there is no requirement, because this was a new invention. They don't have, NIEs have to have dissents, but if you make up a whole new thing, you can make up the rules as you go. That's what they released to the American press and to the American people. It was not even posted at the intelligence website. It was not posted by the Director of National Intelligence or at the CIA. It was posted at the White House press website. So there are all kinds of red flags on this thing at the point on August 30th when it was released and when John Kerry gave this extremely belligerent speech. And I think at that point, most of us had assumed that the decision had been made to go to war.
And that belligerent speech you're referring to, as I recall, he used the phrase, "we know," repeatedly.
Repeatedly.
Like
he used it repeatedly.
Eight or ten times, and just acted as if, you know, we've got all this. He fortunately didn't try to use the phrase slam dunk, but that's what came to mind when I heard him bloviating that day.
Right, and it was him, it was the entire mainstream press corps basically fell for this. Many of the key blog sites were all, you know, all excited about going to war with Syria. It was anyone who sort of tried to raise a concern that this was another rush to judgment was laughed at and knocked down. President Obama, in his speech before the UN in September, his annual speech to the UN, he said that it was beyond reason to doubt that the Syrian government had done this. In other words, those of us who were raising questions, including people within his own intelligence community, were crazy, he was saying. So you had this you had this again, this groupthink that some of us might have thought naively that after this experience with Iraq a decade earlier, there'd be some hesitance to do another groupthink like this on a next door country to Iraq. But here we saw it again. There was this rush to judgment. There was no acceptance that anybody else might have a point. It was slam dunk all over again, and it was aided by groups like Human Rights Watch and the New York Times, and what they did was probably the most significant false element of the whole story, because as I pointed out, there was no evidence presented by the Obama administration, so there was nothing we could check. The one thing that was put out there, which was put out on the front page of the New York Times in September, was this map. And what they had done is they'd taken these two rockets that I mentioned earlier. The azimuth, or that is the angles at which they had reached the Earth, had been calculated by the UN, although the one in Mohammedina had struck a building, so it's kind of a guesswork thing. But then what the New York Times and Human Rights Watch did is they did a vector analysis. They traced back the flight path, and the flight path crossed at a very sensitive Syrian military base 9.5 kilometers away. So this was the slam dunk moment, you idiots who didn't agree with us, now look at this kind of moment. Rub your face in it kind of moment. And then again, but the thing began to collapse as well. For those of us who actually sort of spent the time working this story, it was a very complicated story, granted, mm-hmm. but there was For instance, the Mohammedina rocket didn't have sarin. So the idea of doing a vector analysis of two sarin-carrying rockets didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the rocket scientists had a chance to look at this, and this was a consensus view of among the experts, was that it couldn't go more than a couple of kilometers. So to do a vector analysis going back 9.5 kilometers, more than three times that distance, made no sense. So that collapsed. But Human Rights Watch and the New York Times were not really willing to admit they'd screwed up. The New York Times finally, a couple of days before New Year's in December, when no one was looking, I guess, they did a story in the middle of the newspaper, below the fold, and if you went down to the middle of that story, to the 18th paragraph, you would see them kind of saying, well, yeah, we kind of got this screwed up. So that's how they acknowledge this major front page mistake, which is very comparable, frankly, to what they did in 2002 when Judith Miller and Michael Gordon did their famous piece about the aluminum tubes, which had to be used for centrifuges, which meant that Iraq had reconstituted its nuclear program, which meant that we didn't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. We all recall that charade. And that contributed mightily to a war that killed a lot of people. And here's the New York Times a decade later jumping to another conclusion that almost led to another massive U.S. Military intervention.
And Bob, the question I think is legitimate. When did Human Rights Watch become an expert on vector analysis and the use of chemical weapons? I used to have a high regard for Human Rights Watch, but I have to say in the last 5 to 8 years, I've seen them go kind of squishy on obvious violations of human rights. And in a case like this, they're permitting themselves to be used as a tool for the Obama administration. And the New York Times didn't raise any questions about the credibility of Human Rights Watch conducting this sort of an assessment.
Well, the Times joined them in it. The Times did their own effort to sort of follow the same material and reached the same faulty conclusion. But Human Rights Watch was not an impartial character in this sad drama. It has been pushing for intervention in Syria for quite some time under the R2P principle, the responsibility to protect. And this has become kind of the wave that the neocons are now riding. You now have these hawks that are in the Obama administration who are basically taking the same positions as the neocons. And, of course, there are many neocons that are still in the Obama administration, as we've seen. People like Victoria Nuland, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, who was involved in the regime change in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, what you've had are a number of these hardline, hawkish Democrats, people like Samantha Power, who's the ambassador to the UN, pushing aggressively for intervention in Syria. And Human Rights Watch was in that mix. Some of them, people that run Human Rights Watch, have now sort of recycled in and out of administrations. So it's not what it was when it originated. When it originated, it was actually, I think, called America's Watch. I think we had to deal with them when they were during the Iran-Contra period of the 1980s, when they were sort of countering some of the sellout effect that was happening at Amnesty International, where Amnesty International was sort of falling for many of the Reagan administration's propaganda themes on Nicaragua, for instance.
Yeah.
And it was America's Watch that was raising questions and sort of doing an honest job of trying to put this into more objective terms. But it sort of has become, as the money's gotten bigger and as its people have recycled in and out of government, it's become more of an establishment organization and one that favors U.S. military intervention supposedly on human rights grounds. That is, if there is some kind of civil war going on, they want the U.S. to intervene and stop it, basically, or overthrow the government and put some new result in, which is very similar, basically, to what the neocons were arguing with Iraq. The idea was you had to get rid of this bad dictator, Saddam Hussein. Therefore, part of the justification was to invade Iraq and give it a democracy and so forth. That's pretty much what has now moved into a different realm of, with now the neocons are working with these hawkish Democrats to the same end.
Now, returning to Cy Hirsch's article, there are some remarkable disclosures here, and some are based on anonymous sources, and we have to treat that appropriately. But his article is entitled "The Rat Line and the Red Line and the Rat Line." And the rat line is an important confirmation, because I have long suspected that the incident that occurred in Benghazi on September 11th, a year and a half ago, that was in 2012, that was covered up by the Obama administration because it was a CIA facility. And Pepe Escobar reported to me that they were running arms from that were taken from the Gaddafi stockpile in Libya into Syria, and this basically confirm what Escobar had earlier reported. But the fact that the rat line is running to the al-Nusra front is especially troubling. We've had this array of rebel groups. It's all very murky. You don't know who reports to whom and who's in charge of what. But in the American media, the reporting on al-Nusra has always linked them with al-Qaeda. And so the idea that the U.S. is running arms to the al-Nusra front is a very important issue that I've seen no reaction to in the American media this week.
Well, I think the approach of the major mainstream media is to ignore Hirsch's disclosures. It's been left to some of these bloggers who, I guess, they're auditioning for jobs at the mainstream media to sort of trash the great Cy Hirsch and make fun of him and call him names and the usual treatment. There's a lot of folks invested a lot in the Syria conventional wisdom, and they don't want to admit they were wrong. They don't want to admit they were suckered again. It was bad enough to have to deal with being suckered into the Iraq War fiasco, where nearly 4,500 American soldiers died, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, $1 trillion wasted. The odd thing about that was virtually nobody in official Washington was held accountable or punished. As you could say, Judy Miller at the time sort of lost her job, but she was a rather extraordinary case.
Everybody else got promoted.
Everyone else got either promoted or they're in the same jobs as they were. No one got punished. You're still the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, Fred Hyatt, who got all this stuff wrong, who basically would not allow anyone to raise questions about the WMD case in Iraq and pushed it as fact, not as a question, but as flat fact. He's still there. He's still in the same position. And you had people like Bill Keller, who, after he had bought into the bogus nonsense about Iraq, he was actually promoted to be executive editor of the New York Times. So this was across the board. People had run with a herd, and I guess the reason you stay with the herd is it's safe. As long as you're with the herd, you know, it's hard to sort of pick you off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the situation was. But the problem for the American people and for the world public is that since nobody was fired or really punished significantly, humiliated or anything else over this, over the Iraq disaster, they're still around. And they're still doing the same stuff. They're still taking the same positions. And they bought again into this, into the propaganda themes about Syria. And instead of asking questions and taking some of the tough positions, because obviously there's a lot of bad on both sides in Syria. Neither side is wearing a white hat, but you have to kind of deal with the complexities of it. It doesn't mean that just because we don't like one side that the other side is always right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complicated thing, and you have here also Turkey, and you have the Saudis and the Qataris and other Persian Gulf states funneling money and weapons to a range of rebels in Syria, and the most aggressive ones, the most effective ones, you could argue, are the Islamic fundamentalists,
mm-hmm.
Al-Nusra Front, and the Al-Qaeda branch from Iraq, which is so extreme that even Al-Qaeda basically fired them. So what you have here is a very ugly situation, but no one wants to say again, hey, we bought into a bogus propaganda theme, and we were wrong. So it's easier to ignore Cy Hirsch, or let some of these low-level blogger types take him on and try to make fun of him.
And Bob, you know, one of the comments that is locked into my memory is Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, chair of the Armed Services Committee, talking about funding the moderate elements among the rebels in Syria. And this, to me, is just evidence of how fatuous that idea is. You know, who are moderate elements that we can arm and hope that if they prevail, they wouldn't turn those arms on us? And this, to me, has been one of the real illogical aspects of commentary on the potential for American direct involvement in Syria.
Right, and again, it's double standards. You know, what right does the United States really have to start arming people, whether they're terrorists or whether they're rebels in another country?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if say Vladimir Putin today decides to send a lot of weapons to these Eastern Ukrainian protesters holding buildings, we would call that terrorism or aggression, or we'd have some ugly word for it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't say, oh, he's just giving weapons to some nice guys who are defending their local area and their rights. We'd be outraged. We'd all be outraged. But when the United States does it, it's okay. And mm-hmm. so there's an endless double standard that we keep confronting when we come to this. And the United States really, even if there had been a chemical weapon attack by the Syrian government, the United States is on does not have legal grounds to go bomb Syria. Now, the fact that the evidence is extremely weak and may well have been a provocation that the rebels had conducted to try to provoke the U.S. to intervene against the Syrian government makes it even worse. But this idea that the United States has this some kind of special right to go around and invade any country it wants. And then if any other country does something similar, we turn around with this sort of cognitive dissonance, and not just the government, but the press corps too, and denounce it. No one else has a right to do this, even if the situation is extremely understandable in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
We do. And that gets down to the core of this, the buying in of the U.S. press corps into these hypocrisies and double standards. That then requires, in a way, false reporting, because if you're trying to make the U.S. always look justified, and anyone else who does something, anything similar, always look unjustified, you have to, by logic, impose false journalistic standards or make things up, which is often how it turns out.
Well, and in the recent episode relating to Ukraine, and you know, we talked before that we started recording about John Kerry, lecturing Putin that it's not 21st century behavior to just invade a country and then annex it.
under false, no, he said to violate a country's sovereignty under false pretenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the obvious point that anyone would have made was that John Kerry, as a senator, voted in 2002, which is part of the 21st century, to invade Iraq under false pretenses. But when Kerry's quote was used, I didn't see it in any mainstream news organization. Did they say, however, you know, there's the there should be the however graph that follows this. Or, in fact, you know, John Kerry himself, in the 21st century, approved having the U.S. go halfway around the world, not next door, not in an area like Crimea that has been historically part of Russia, with the Crimean people saying, we want to be part of Russia, we're going to vote to be part of Russia. Instead, the United States flies halfway around the world, sends its troops halfway around the world to invade Iraq, under which were really false pretenses. I'm not sure what the false pretenses were exactly in Crimea. The Crimeans had asked both their legislature and then through a referendum to rejoin Russia, which they've been part of since the 1700s. So, but you know, suddenly that act has to be denounced and called all kinds of ugly names, but the U.S. going halfway around the world and attacking Iraq is fine, or going halfway around the world and attacking Libya, which happened just a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
Which Kerry was also in support of. So, and he was quite eager to go attack Syria just a year ago, or less than a year ago. So this idea that John Kerry should be able to lecture anybody about the need to recognize the sovereignty of other nations is absurd, and for the U.S. National Press Corps not to note this red flag being waved at them is even more outrageous. So Kerry gets to say something denouncing Putin in a much murkier situation, frankly, than what we have done repeatedly,
and
one calls him on it.
And it's cartoonish, Bob. I mean, the biggest reaction to John Kerry has been laughter over these outlandish remarks that he has made recently. And these disclosures about the episode with Syria undermine his credibility even further. Now, in addition to Hirsch's confirmation of the rat line, this weapons supply line running from Benghazi through Turkey and into Syria, the fascinating part that he opens up is the role of Syria the role of Turkey in the Syrian civil war, and the way it appears that President Erdogan, I guess is how they pronounce that G, is kind of being left hanging out to dry. And Hirsch kind of goes into Bob Woodward mode here, where he reports on the White House meetings last summer when Erdogan came to Washington, and in particular a very tense exchange over a dinner. And since we know there were only a handful of participants, John Kerry, Tom Donilon, Barack Obama, and Erdogan and a foreign minister, and also his security chief, the people who leaked this to Hirsch are on a very short list. But it is fascinating to hear about this very testy exchange between Obama and the Turks.
Well, to give Obama some credit, he did decide at the last minute not to go ahead with this bombing of Syria. And what I think an interesting part of Hirsch's story is how expansive this attack would have been. There was talk at the time back last summer that it would be a pinprick, if you remember. It now appears that pinprick had been expanded and expanded as the planning went on, and as more and more of these hawks inside the Obama administration got to weigh in with more things they wanted bombed, that the U.S. military was sending over a fleet of B-52s to carry out this assault. And the plan was not just to sort of punish the Assad regime for supposedly crossing the red line. The idea was to eliminate Assad's military and all his security forces. basically paved the way for the rebels to win regime change. It was not just a point of protest or Americans being angry about the use of chemical weapons. It was going to be a regime change, similar more to what happened in Libya, when there was the nose under the tent of protecting some civilians, and before you know it, the U.S. and the French and others were bombing Gaddafi's military back to the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the plan. And to Obama's credit, I guess, is that when he, and I think I was hearing at the time that some of these intelligence people who were not at all on board with the conclusions of the Syrian responsibility, Syrian government responsibility, were talking to Obama and saying, listen, we just don't know who did this. We're not even sure exactly what happened. And so Obama pulled back. He pulled back. There was also political resistance from the British in their parliament and in the U.S. Congress, but he did pull back, and he was receptive to President Putin coming forward with the plan to have the Syrians give up all their chemical weapons, although the Assad still denied any role in the August 21st attack, and that that would be the way to resolve this. And that has moved forward, and despite some problems getting some of the chemicals out, seems to be moving ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So Obama does deserve some credit for being open to a peaceful escape from this box that he locked himself into, the so-called red line. But the Turks, who had been in on this thing from the beginning and wanted to, were very eager to get rid of Assad, their next door neighbor. They are part of the Sunni aspect of Islam. Assad represents the Alawites, which is part of the Shia segment of Islam, and he was also allied to the Shia regime in Iran. And is also now, of course, tied to the Iraqi government, which is also Shia. So there has been this crescent, and there's been a Shia crescent that has evolved, partly with the U.S. assistance by taking out Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but it has evolved from Iran through Iraq and Syria to Lebanon. And so some of the Sunni governments, especially the Saudis, who see themselves as the geopolitical foes of the Iranians, have wanted to get rid of Assad as a way to break the so-called Shia crescent. And Turkey had bought into that, coming from a somewhat different political position than the Saudis, but still they joined in on this. And they were pretty far out there in terms of having supported not just the more secular opposition, but the Islamic fundamentalist opposition, Nusra Front, and other groups that are very much into the terrorist realm.
Mm-hmm.
So this was something where the Turks found themselves sort of out on a limb. Obama was sawing it off, and they were upset. And I think I can't vouch for Hirsch's account there. I've not talked to anybody at that meeting about it, but it seems to make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. And the other piece here that I find curious is that the U.S. has been bitten, and its allies have, in major events recently by leaked, intercepted phone call recordings.
And it's ironic, isn't it?
This is what exposed Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. There have been subsequent intercepts from that zone released. And now Erdogan is clinging to power. He tried to shut down Twitter and YouTube because purloined recordings of a conversation he had with one of his children about you got to hide all the cash at your house were released and have had him reeling because of the embarrassment of these disclosures. And so to see, the tactics that we've been using kind of blow back on us is, there's at minimum some irony there, Bob.
Well, I think also more substantively on the issue of the Turkish intercept, there was also this discussion among some of Erdogan's intelligence people about staging a false flag attack inside Syria,
mm-hmm.
where there's a a shrine that is considered Turkish territory, though it's a religious thing inside Syria. And the point was that there would be some attack staged on it, and the Turks could then intervene to protect their territory inside Syria. So it's not clear how far that went, but it did indicate that the Turkish intelligence was thinking in these terms. That's why Hirsch mentions this in passing, although it was a Reuters article about this. But it does indicate that the Turks were getting fairly desperate. They were looking for ways to turn things around in Syria, where the government has clearly gotten the upper hand on the rebels, and the rebel movement, while it probably will not disappear entirely, has been marginalized substantially, partly because of infighting between some of the more moderate elements, the secular elements anyway, and these extremists who actually became the backbone of the military operation.
Mm-hmm.
Much has happened in Ukraine. There's a similarity there where the extremists were the most dedicated, the most willing to die, I guess, the most willing to put their lives on the line, and the best organized. So you had in Syria, you had that in the form of the Al-Qaeda branches. In Ukraine, you had these neo-Nazi groups that were very well organized as stormtroopers. That's what they do. I guess they march around all the time. So instead of having these younger people that might have been more idealistic demonstrators who were not organized to really fight a battle, it was the neo-Nazis who stepped to the fore on February 21st and 22nd to overthrow the Ukrainian government. So you see something similar where if you want regime change, it appears you probably have to get in bed with some of these people. And it seems that happened in Ukraine. It happened in it almost happened in Syria and in places like Libya. We saw the same thing where where the U.S. the people that were being supported by the U.S. bombing campaigns were in many ways people who had been associated with Islamic terrorism.
If I were a real cynic, Bob, I might suggest that these are almost scripted events.
Well, yeah, well, I suppose you could be a cynic that way, and there certainly is a pattern that you could cite. I mean, and going back to Afghanistan, when in the 1980s, when the Reagan administration sided aggressively with some of the worst elements of Afghan society, warlords and drug traffickers and people who were engaged in horrible human rights violations, because the Reagan administration felt that giving a black eye to the Soviet Union was more important.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that led us to the Taliban and to a safe haven for Osama bin Laden, who came to prominence because he was part of the effort to support the Afghan Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We saw similar things, I suppose, back in our hemisphere, where the Reagan administration and other U.S. governments have supported some of the most reactionary neo-Nazi-style forces throughout our region, the Guatemalan military, the Salvadoran military, the Contras in Nicaragua. These are the Argentine death squads, the Chilean government under Pinochet. You could go through a long list of places where the United States has backed extremely violent, extremely reactionary forces to achieve some geopolitical goal.
Well, Bob, I always appreciate the context that you offer to these events and also just your strong reporting. And I just want to pull this one quote from your article, and I'll link to the collapsing Syria sarin case in the show file for this podcast. But you say, President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry owe it to the public to recant their rush to judgment of last summer and refocus U.S. intelligence on this clear and present danger. Sure, it's not what Obama and Kerry want to do, admit they misled the people about the certainty of the U.S. government's case against Assad, but they have a responsibility to put their egos aside and assess what is possibly an actual terrorist threat. And, you know, we have this, you know, these layers of smoke obscure the real picture. But I think we need to get into the real picture and deal with reality instead of many of these illusions that seem to be generated by government operatives.
Well, the point I was making in that quote you made was this issue of if the Nusra Front, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, if they actually now have the capacity to produce sarin and deploy it, if they indeed were the culprits, the people that committed the horrible crime last year in outside of Damascus, then this is something that the U.S. government needs to take seriously. In fact, this was one of the reasons we supposedly went to war in Iraq, was to prevent Saddam Hussein from sharing this kind of stuff with Al-Qaeda. If an Al-Qaeda affiliate now can do it, can create sarin and figure out how to kill people with it, that's something that people need to take a serious look at. And instead of everyone sort of getting into a defensive crouch because they may have gotten the story wrong last summer, they should be mature enough and responsible enough to say, we need now to take a serious look at this and take some action on it if required in terms of protecting the American people from this, what may be a real threat now.
Mm-hmm. Robert Perry, thank you for joining us today. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I always learn a lot from Bob Perry. Hope you do too. Be sure to follow his work at consortiumnews.com. And thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.